Live from Chicago, this is Bruce Dumont with our Beyond the Beltway analysis of national politics, featuring occasional injections of rumor and innuendo, all offered up by our panel of political insiders, pundits, power brokers, public servants, and most importantly, plain-speaking Americans from coast to coast. Tonight featuring commentary by Gidi Nishant, Nariman Safari, and Mark Zivin. Our program tonight coming to you from the Sirius XM studios on Chicago's Great West Side, where our toll-free lines are open at 1-800-723-8289. That's 1-800-723-8289. If you'd like to email us a comment, our email address is btbtalk@aol.com. And if you'd like to join us on the World Wide Web, the website is beyondthebeltway.com. Tonight we have two topics to share with you. In hour number two, we're going to be talking about taxes and the significant budget problems that are being faced by virtually all 50 states. What are those states doing about it? Will there be a real live tax revolt in America? That will be topic in the second hour of our broadcast this evening. But again, in hour number one, we lead with the foreign policy. And again, the elections and the reaction to the elections in Iran. Thousands, tens of thousands, perhaps hundreds of thousands of Iranians are in the street. You've been watching it on television for the last several days on international television. There have been reports anywhere from 10 to 20 Iranians have been killed. Hundreds of protesters have been sent to hospitals with injury. And we are going to be talking about American reaction to that and how should we react. But I want to begin our discussion by getting a sense, because at the core of this, there was an election. People went to vote. The results came in. The side that lost didn't like the election results. And there have been the charges of irregularities. Many of those things we're sort of familiar with in this country. It goes back to our own presidential election in 2000. Gidi Nishant, thanks very much for being with us. You are, longtime listeners know that you're a frequent guest in our program, a research fellow at the Hoover Institution, born in Baghdad, but your Islamic studies and your expertise is in Iranian politics. So my question to you is, as Americans, how do we know if the irregularities were really irregular? Based on what you've read, heard, is that a legitimate charge?
Okay. Well, before the election took place, most surveys suggested that Mir Mohammad Mousavi would be the winner of this election. There had been many questionnaires, and he was the one who was challenging the president, Mr. Ahmadinejad. And then, according to official sources in Iran, the government itself, about 85% of the population that could vote cast their ballot. And they don't have a digital kind of voting pattern, and these were supposed to be counted by hand. 2 hours after the vote was cast, the Ministry of Interior, which is responsible for counting the votes, announced that Mr. Ahmadinejad had won by 11 million votes more than Mr. Mousavi. That means 11 million more, or 66% of the vote. And the other three candidates received about 33% of the vote. Well, so this became obvious to many people who were watching the results, that how could the Ministry of Interior have counted the vote so quickly?
Okay.
So this is this is why the whole thing began.
Nariman Safari also joins us. He was born in Tehran. Thank you very much. He's a businessman, also an American citizen, been in the United States since 1976. But again, would you add anything to Gidi's assessment? And is it safe to say that the election results are highly suspect?
Thank you for being here, Bruce, allowing me to be here. I would say, yes, I would second what Gidi had said, and I would add that actually on the, you know, the government in Iran, they had to extend the polling hours by 2 hours and then another 2 hours. So they had an additional 4 hours of the polling stations being open because the turnout was so heavy. And everybody was thought that, and with a heavy turnout election, Ahmadinejad is in trouble because he has a very small base that is that is great at getting out the vote on a low turnout election and winning him.
But and that historically worldwide, if there's unusual turnouts, it generally means the people are asking for change.
Exactly. Exactly.
Okay. I want to put all these things in context. I mean, certainly everyone knows in the United States there are people who are projected to win, and sometimes there are upsets. So, I mean, the fact that he was running ahead in the polls is just one thing. But, again, I want to put that in context. Mark Zivin also joins us. Thanks very much, Mark Zivin. And your assessment of just the first part of our discussion about is there really bona fide irregularities here, and can we dismiss that from the discussion?
Well, yes. I think I'd just add, too, that, you know, it adds up. There are a few more things also that were a little bit strange, like Mosavi lost in his own hometown, and I think this was why the reaction was so strong in Iran, was because it. I mean, if you're going to steal an election, one would think you would do it with a little more sense than how it was done. It was almost amateurish in how quickly they tried to do it.
Is the quickness of the call, of all the things you've discussed, Gidi, or we've discussed thus far, is the quickness of this call by someone who obviously is somewhat of a house agent of Ahmadinejad, is that the most suspect of all the elements here?
Well, of course, because how could they have counted 40 million votes? And what's really brought out the anger among Iranian voters, even including some Ahmadinejad supporters, is the fact that they believe the votes were not even counted, that ahead of time, the Guardian Council, Ahmadinejad, and the Supreme Leader decided the percentages, and then they announced it. And, of course, the next day, the next morning, the Supreme Leader announced that he congratulated Mr. Ahmadinejad.
We have a caller on the line. Let's go to Mike in Knoxville, Tennessee, who wants to weigh in just on this issue. Mike, go ahead. You're on the air. Mike, are you there?
Yes, sir. I was listening to Gidi there, and I got to say that she's got this either absolutely wrong or she's misinformed. I was listening to the KNOX news down here when ABC reported that the Iranian Election Commission reported at 19% of the vote counted, Ahmadinejad was ahead. At 19%, that was the first initial thing that she's stating, that they counted that he had won. Okay, the second thing was that in all surveys and polls had done, since there was no exit polling or anything like we have down here, but the best estimates they had was that Mosavi had been, or his actual name is Mousavi, had support among the upper class, the upper middle class, and the foreign educated university students. Whereas Mr. Ahmadinejad had support among the rural areas, the small towns, and the villages.
All right, listen, stay on the line. We're gonna go for a break. I want to get everybody's reaction to that, because what you're suggesting is that that the projection suggested that Ahmadinejad was ahead, and what you're suggesting is that the opposition candidate jumped in and declared victory before it was in sight. That's what's on the table. We're going to break. We're going to come back. I want to get your reaction to that. And then we're going to move beyond the election to the streets demonstrations.
With welcome rewards from Hotels.com, you get a free night after accumulating 10 nights with any of their partner hotels.
Surely my boutique hotel is not included in that.
Yes, it is, lady.
My band, Sned Leplin, stays in chain hotels just off the freeway. Those included?
With Hotels.com, you bet, Mr. Brojangles.
What about a bed and breakfast?
Faux shizzle.
Hotels on the moon?
No.
Accumulate 10 nights, even at different hotels, and earn a free night. Welcome rewards from Hotels.com. Smart. So smart. Some restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hey, over here.
Who said that?
It's me, hon. Last year's Father's Day gift. You know, the nose hair trimmer.
Oh.
So what's this I hear about you getting him a TomTom GPS this year?
Well, Dad's kind of obsessed with shortcuts. So with TomTom's IQ routes, he'll always know the fastest way to get anywhere.
What, are you trying to make me look bad or something?
No, I
just... Gee, I wonder what Dad'll like more. Brilliant all-knowing TomTom or a nose hair trimmer? It is so over for me.
Say goodbye to lame Father's Day gifts. Say hello to TomTom.
From Knoxville, Tennessee to Bakersfield, California, you're listening to Beyond the Beltway, 1-800-723-8289. Michael from Knoxville is on the line, listening to us on WNOX this evening. And, Nari, you wanted to challenge some of the things that Michael had to say about the interpretation of the election results.
Yes, actually, there is good evidence that during the election night, about an hour after the polls had closed, the Ministry of Interior called Mr. Mousavi and asked him, it looks like the early returns are coming in and it looks like you're going to win by a landslide. Why don't you prepare your victory speech? And then half an hour later, his headquarters in Gaytariyeh neighborhood in Tehran got raided by the Revolutionary Guard. And they said that your victory celebration is going to become a velvet revolution, a green revolution, and we're not going to allow that. And they arrested him and put him under house arrest. So all these figures that are coming out of the Iranian government about the statistics on the vote are very unreliable. Ahmadinejad has really politicized the rank and file of the Iranian government to produce figures that are favorable to him, whether it's about inflation during the campaign, unemployment.
Okay.
Et cetera.
All right. One last question based on at least what Michael has said. I want to get everybody's reaction to it. Was the implication that what we're watching here may be the elites, Ahmadinejad and the elites, the elites being support the anti-Ahmadinejad forces, and that really Ahmadinejad is the voice of the masses, the rural communities, maybe the lesser educated, and that what part of this analysis of this election and what's going on in Iran really is differences in education and economic stature and everything else. Is there how much of this story is that dynamic in your view, Gideon?
Well, I think this is partly true, but we also have to remember that 60% of Iranian people live in cities. Iran is an urban society. Most people live in cities. And what Ahmadinejad has done is that he has created a fund for giving to poor people who would vote for him. And what happens during elections, and especially this election, they would bring people from rural areas. They would first take their ID cards. After they would vote, they would give them a sum of money. And in order to do this, one of the Iranian budget of this year was in deficit by $1 billion from the oil money. They didn't know where it went. And most Iranians, economists, politicians, think that this money has gone to this fund, which is called Helping the Poor, or which is what Ahmadinejad has been doing.
And by the way,
this is
a practice. We do this program from Chicago. The practice you're describing has happened in the city of Chicago for many, many years. And it used to be chickens for those who were on welfare. They would get chickens. Sometimes there were cash payments. This is nothing new. It happens throughout the world and has happened for hundreds or thousands of years.
Well, this is true, though.
Right?
But of course it is true.
But he's doing that now.
He's doing it now in Iran. And the thing is that if you look at any of the pictures coming from all over Iran, not only Tehran, but Isfahan, Shiraz, Tabriz, you would see a lot of women who seem religious because they wear the chador, and men who don't seem that middle class or prosperous who've been joining these demonstrations. The point is, it's not that they are opposed to Ahmadinejad because he's a populist, but because they are incensed and angered by the fact that they feel their votes have not counted. And this is one of the slogans of the election, that our votes have been stolen, and that's why they're demonstrating.
Mark. Well, one of the things in looking at Iran before this, I used to get into arguments with people who would talk about Iran as a theocracy. And I said, yes, it is within limits, because it's more complicated than that. And this is one of the problems that we have, I think, in this country, at looking at other cultures and even other foreign countries, where we just hear certain things. And I would venture to say that most Americans would think that Ahmadinejad is the head of Iran, whereas I think people are slowly learning now that it's really the supreme leader. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that surprised me, actually, or one of the things that one of my assumptions prior to this election was that within the rules of the game that were set, which is to say that the candidates that were vetted, that got through the system, which eliminated, I think there were 200 or 300 candidates, and there were ended up with six, and then it went down to four. But that once all that was done, then you had a fair election. That was my assumption. I used to argue with that prior to this last election. And I think the difference that I see now is that that assumption, if whether it was true or not, has totally, to the Iranians themselves, has been eliminated now.
To reiterate what Marx had said, what you are really seeing in a way happening in Iran is about an inherent contradiction inside the Islamic Republic. Ahmadinejad belongs to a faction within the Islamic Republic that believes the government should be more Islamic than a republic. That's why I believe that they have a contempt for actually elections and this process. They are really Islamic Republic is a republic, but it has these religious hierarchy that sits on top of the institutions of the republic.
Is that why the supreme by the Ayatollah, the supreme
Khomeini.
Leader Khomeini, is that why he basically tried to put the kibosh on the election and say, it's over, folks, go home, get out of the streets?
Exactly.
Because he wants to put a lid on it.
Exactly. He has.
But not all members, not all religious leaders do want to put a lid on it.
Absolutely. And I think he got very worried when he saw the size of the support for Mousavi and Mousavi's platform, which meant greater freedom for the youth, greater equality of women, opening up to the West, and opening up the market, freer economic activity. And it was this thing that frightened him, and it was he who decided ahead of time that we cannot put up with this kind of development in Iran because it would undermine the policies that he supported, which was what Ramin here said, Mr. Safavi said, that he wanted to keep the Islamic Republic, or he believed in an Islamic state rather than a Republican state.
Now, another name that people are hearing is Rafsanjani, who used to be the president, is now one of the wealthiest men in the country, and he was one of the architects of the revolution back in 1979. So he is no friend of the United States, but his daughter has been arrested. Some other relatives allegedly have been arrested.
She was released this afternoon.
She was released
right,
this afternoon.
Was.
But she was picked up
right.
because she had given a speech which authorities felt was over the top. Now, he also, in addition to being the wealthiest man in the country, he sits on two key bodies, one of which is it the Assembly of Experts?
Right.
And who are they?
The Assembly of Experts are basically a body of clerics, high-ranking clerics, who basically appoint the position of the supreme leader. That is the Islamic part within the Islamic Republic. That is the body that guarantees that the republic does not go out of the way too far from the path of Islam. And they have their own control mechanisms on
it. So is Rafsanjani, he is on that assembly.
He's the president of the
assembly. He's the president of the assembly.
Yes.
So he's the president of the assembly.
Yes.
But he is at odds here with the supreme leader.
With Khamenei.
Exactly. So my question is, the supreme leader, if he's not getting along with the president, how many other members are there in that assembly? And can Rafsanjani, can he throw the Ayatollah out?
That is the $64 question that you just pointed
at. Well, I'm glad we finally got that.
It is heard that rumor mill is all rife. We haven't heard anything from Rafsanjani since the day of the election. He has been completely silent, and he's been hidden. The rumors are that he's in the holy city of Qom, and he's talking to the Council of the Grand Ayatollahs, and he's lobbying for the removal of the supreme leader.
Now, here's the other $64 question, which, again, I think wherever you're listening to the program this evening, this is probably the one you've been waiting for me to ask. And that is, obviously, the American people have heard so many horrible things about Ahmadinejad. We all know that he's not a good guy. He's moving forward with the development of nuclear power and or weapons. And again, we have been told what a bad guy he is for about the last 5 years. So maybe part of the American people are rooting for the other guy. Tell us more about the other guy, well, Gita. And again, is he someone we really should be rooting for, or is he any better than Ahmadinejad when it comes to what his goals are?
Well, I think Mr. Mousavi was prime minister, one of the founders of the Islamic Republic. He was a prime minister for 8 years during the Iran-Iraq war, and he was very close to Ayatollah Khomeini, and he was trusted by Ayatollah Khomeini, and Ayatollah Khomeini trusted him more than he trusted Khamenei, who was also there from the beginning. Now, what is the difference between them? Mr. Mousavi believes that the Islamic Republic should evolve into a kinder, gentler kind of republic. He believes that people deserve to have a better life through opening up of the economy. He believes that the sanctions have hurt Iran and the poor, and therefore he believes that by trying to establish relationship with the U.S., he can have the sanctions lifted, but he does not want to do away with the Islamic Republic.
I want to talk more about that. We do have to pause. 1-800-723-8289. We have experts on what you're watching on television about what's happening in the streets of Tehran and all over Iran right now. You've got a great opportunity to call in with your questions, trying to separate fact from fiction tonight on Beyond the Beltway live from Chicago.
I'm Felix. I've been doing body art and tattoos for over 15 years. It's amazing. I get people in here all the time who ask me about fading or removing a tattoo they don't want anymore. Up till this year, I've really had nothing to help them that is effective and painless. And then I discovered Wrecking Balm. It's an easy 3-step daily fading system. In just a few months, the darkest, deepest pigments, they easily start to fade without any discoloring, blemishing, or scarring the skin. Wrecking Balm is really the best thing for tattoo regret. It's my only recommendation if you want to clear the canvas of some real funky body art.
Wrecking Balm, the devastatingly effective tattoo fade system. Undemanding daily fading. Zero pain, zero discomfort.
Call right now for your in-home 60-day risk-free trial of Wrecking Balm at 1-800-507-4206. That's 1-800-507-4206. Fade your tattoo now by calling 1-800-507-4206. That's 1-800-507-4206.
Bruce Dumont back in Chicago. Thank you very much for joining us tonight from coast to coast and border to border, taking America's political pulse. Interested tonight in your reaction to the street demonstrations in Tehran and whether or not President Obama has been firm enough. Some Republicans have suggested that he's been a little too timid. The White House has argued that he doesn't want to say anything that conceivably could be viewed as inflammatory, so that those who are exercising their rights on the streets of Iran, they don't want to be viewed as tools or puppets of the United States. I want to get your reaction. This is obviously the first major international crisis of the Obama administration. It's the one Joe Biden told us was coming. I think we all knew that such a thing was coming. How is he doing in his utterances thus far as President of the United States? 1-800-723-8289. Giti Nishat is here. She is a research fellow at the Hoover Institution, professor of Islamic and Middle Eastern history at the University of Illinois at Chicago. She's written extensively on the role of women in Iran and Islamic society and has authored The Origins of Modern Reform in Iran and has written for the Encyclopedia of the Modern Islamic World. She's a member of the Iranian Studies Association. Also joining us this evening is Nariman Safavi, right? Safavi, yes. Got it right?
Correct.
Born in Tehran. He is a diamond in the diamond business. He is a businessman, came to the United States in Chicago in 1976, is a United States citizen. Last time he was back home was 3 years ago and has many members of his family that live in Iran and texts and talks with him on a regular basis. Yes. And Mark Gazivan also joins us. He is a CPA when he's not on the radio. He is also the treasurer of the Jewish Reconstructionist Federation and also with an organization called J Street PAC, which is a Jewish PAC, which is
pro-Israel,
pro-Israel,
pro-peace,
pro-peace.
Two-state solution.
And as a counterpoint to AIPAC.
It's we're arguing for an open debate on the Middle East in general. And I think that we believe that the more we know and the more we debate these issues, the better solutions will come to.
To summarize your position, is it generally your position that American foreign policy and congressional action has generally been a knee-jerk reaction that bends over backwards for Israel?
Well, I wouldn't – no. I mean, I think that Israel is a very good ally of the United States and obviously likewise. I think what we feel is that in order for there to be peace in the Middle East, that a solution has to be fair to all parties. And that's true. It's just basic. You know, in business, it's the same way. If you're going to have a – if you're going to do a business deal, that deal is really going – only going to work long term if it's fair to both parties. And I think that we've been in a situation where the United States has been seen by many to be the – be Israel's surrogate in some of the negotiations. And we're arguing that the United States needs to be involved, that we need to get these two parties to the table, that it's in our national interest to have peace in the Middle East. It won't happen without our help, but we need to be seen as an honest broker.
You're a member of an organization, as is Nari. It's called the National Iranian American Council. You told me before the broadcast it was basically formed because members of this group felt that there was an administration and a government push to create sort of the drumbeats of war, a prelude to eventually confrontation with Iran. Have I summarized properly?
NIAC itself was started, I think, just to get Iranian Americans involved in the American political process. Iranian Americans, exactly, as you'll find out, have been very successful in this country. But I think culturally, for whatever reason, they've not wanted to be involved politically. Mm-hmm. They've just sort of been, you know, in the back seat. And I think that it was started really for them to have the voice that any group should have in this country.
But there was a fear of the drumbeats of war, were there not, Nari?
Yes, that was later on in the history of NIAC. NIAC has been around for about 5 years, and we're the largest grassroots Iranian-American organization. We have several thousand members across the country. But later on, we started to get involved in the issues of war and lobbying against the potential war with Iran. And that's how I met Mark.
That's how I got involved was about 2 years ago. It was my concern for getting involved with NIAC was that I began to hear the same type of rhetoric that we heard prior to the run-up to the war against Iraq. And I think that that it's hard at this point for anyone to deny in retrospect that there was not enough debate prior to that war, that we didn't as a country understand our enemy. We didn't understand the culture. We didn't understand some of the unintended consequences. And as some people have said in the State Department, the first thing you do when you want to deal with a political situation, a foreign policy situation, is you need to check the checkables. That is, how much can we learn about the situation, the other culture, the other country, what we're getting into? You need to do all that homework first before you begin to make decisions. And I don't feel it was done with Iraq, and I think we're running into the same problems now with Iran.
Well, I think what I regret is that Iran could have been a major ally of the U.S. in helping us in Iraq, in helping us in Afghanistan, in minimizing the danger we're facing today in Pakistan. And by keeping it at bay and viewing it as a hostile state, we have really made our own situation a lot worse. So we should have really done that in order to help ourselves, not so much the Iranians.
But,
and, of course, by lifting the sanctions against Iran, we would have helped the very groups who would have been our greatest allies, the middle class and people who could get involved and expand their business activities and et cetera.
And
so we really hurt ourselves.
Your point earlier was that that Mosavi, who said that he was willing to be a martyr if need be, who the people are in the streets because they support him and they support what he stands for. Insofar as the goal of nuclearizing Iran, either for purposes of commercial development or potential defensive or aggressive weaponry, there really isn't too much difference between he and Ahmadinejad.
Not as far as nuclear technology goes. They both believe that Iran needs nuclear technology because they have excellent scientific and mathematics schools, and they are training schools who can do very well at major universities in America like MIT, Stanford,
right.
Chicago, and they feel that without knowledge of technology, Iran is going to fall behind. But the idea of building bombs is something that's really abhorrent to many Iranians because they know that even if they build one bomb, what can they do with it? And
To put a fine point on it, for especially as an Iranian American, Ahmadinejad, is he an embarrassment? He's an embarrassment. And yes. Is it the saber rattling and we're going to wipe Israel off the face of the map? Is that the rhetoric that basically may play very well in some of the rural, uneducated precincts of Iran? And frankly, as a businessman living in the United States, as an American, you and maybe tens of millions of your former countrymen back in Iran are embarrassed by this guy.
Well, actually, it's not just me. I think during the campaign, all three candidates basically that were running against Ahmadinejad called him a national disgrace. And they said that you have sullied the image of Iran abroad, but with your bellicose rhetoric and with your Holocaust denying, which has nothing to do with pursuing the national interest of Iran on the global stage. And even Ahmadinejad himself, they were all jumping all over each other, the four candidates, say that I am the best person to engage Obama in this historic opportunity. So there were all the issue of relationship with the United States in particular and with the West was a huge campaign issue. And all the candidates were trying to show themselves to be the right person to engage Obama. And even Ahmadinejad, who's prone to irresponsible and bellicose rhetoric, was trying to reinvent himself as the right person to engage Obama.
Now, the other thing that was going on during the campaign is this is the name we discussed in the last segment, Rafsanjani, again, one of the wealthiest men in the country, and again, a major powers player in the country. Ahmadinejad accused him and his family of being corrupt. Are they corrupt?
Well,
is there truth to that?
Well, the one point I would like to emphasize is that the reason for opposition to Ahmadinejad is not the fact that he sullied Iran's reputation by his irresponsible statements about Israel and some other countries, but the fact that Iran's economy is in shambles. Unemployment is very high. It's about 25%, and Iran's population under 25, many of them, the unemployment among them may be 40%, even though they're highly educated.
By the way, there are 70 million Iranians. Two-thirds of them are under age 30.
Okay.
Yes.
And this population doesn't have jobs, doesn't have prospects of getting married. And once the price of oil went down internationally, it meant Iran or Ahmadinejad himself could no longer subsidize many of the programs he was offering in order to buy people's votes. So this is really one of the major issues that is at the heart of this demonstration against him and the support for Mr. Mousavi. So going back, what was the other question? Sorry, I forgot about that.
Well, I forgot it too.
Okay. But anyway, this is very important.
Mark?
And I think we shouldn't lose sight of it. It's not only, and therefore, Mousavi believes that by restoring Iran's relationship with the world, he can improve the economy, open free markets in Iran, and this way create many jobs, which is what Iranians really want.
We've got to pause. 1-800-723-8289. Mark, I know you want to comment as well as Nari. 1-800-723-8289 from coast to coast and border. Border tonight, we're talking about Iran. What's happening in the streets of Iran as we speak tonight, live from Chicago.
Are you losing your home to foreclosure? Are you behind on your mortgage and fear the worst? The law firm of Pomery & Associates would like to offer you a free, no-obligation consultation that will show you how to stop foreclosure, reduce your interest rates, and save thousands on your mortgage. Do not let this economic slowdown take your home from you and your family. You have worked too hard. Pomery & Associates is an attorney-based loan modification firm that can negotiate the terms of your mortgage so you can afford to live in and enjoy your home. Call for a free, no-obligation consultation. There is no cost to find out how this program can help you save your home. Call 800-632-7885. That's 800-632-7885. It does not matter how far behind you are on payment or what your credit score is. Pomery & Associates is here to listen and help. Call now, 800-632-7885. 800-632-7885.
Bruce Dumont back in Chicago. We've been talking about Iran and some political reaction to the president's rhetoric of this past week. His denunciation not as strong as some people would like it to have been. This week, George Will was a guest, as he normally is. He dismissed as foolish criticism of those that suggest that Obama's position and rhetoric should have been stronger. Dick Lugar, who is a ranking Republican on the Foreign Affairs Committee from Indiana, said that Washington must continue to focus on Iran's nuclear program, not the protest in the streets, even if that means direct negotiations with the Tehran regime. Lindsey Graham and John McCain both basically said the president was being too soft, that he should be speaking more firmly. But again, there was an election and they lost. Remember that. And Representative Pete Hoekstra of Michigan, who's the ranking Republican on the House Permanent Select Committee on Intelligence, said the United States and Europe need to begin to deal with the reality that Iran will soon be a nuclear armed power. Policy has to shift from blocking Iran's nuclear program to helping a more moderate regime take control over that nuclear program. He said that on Fox News Sunday. So again, one of the key Republicans in the House seeming to offer a different perspective, at least from a Republican perspective. I would assume, Mark, that Representative Hoekstra is someone that brought a little smile to your face.
Well, yes and no. I think that there's a lot of questions about Iran's nuclear program. And that isn't to say that we shouldn't all be very wary of where it's going. But I think that any objective observer would say that it's not clear where it's going. There's evidence from the National Intelligence Estimate, very recent, of about 2 years ago, that they had stopped developing nuclear weapons. There's a lot of disinformation. And this reminds me of where we were in 2002, 2003, before the invasion of Iraq, which I think we all remember we were told that those weapons were ready to be launched. I mean, literally, this was the kind of rhetoric that we were hearing from Washington, and we got there and they couldn't be found anywhere. And I don't know, but and I think that an Iranian a nuclear Iran poses tremendous problems to the world. But on the other hand, that to not engage, to only deal with the country on one basis doesn't help you, because if the representative is right and if they do become nuclear, then we have to have some other – we have to be ready for that. And if we concentrate only on eliminating it, and that's going to be the – I mean, literally the end of the world. I think we're hearing that from the Prime Minister of Israel. We're hearing that from certain people in the United States. Instead of saying, let us engage, let's talk, let's learn.
We've only got about 4 minutes left. I want to look ahead. Gidi, we don't know what's going to happen next, but give us your projection of where you think things will go. How does this thing – can this thing be ratcheted down, or is it going to pop?
Well, it's hard to predict. I think it's quite a crisis. There's going to be violence. my own personal feeling is that Mr. Khamenei, their spiritual leader, has lost his nerve, and this is why he's getting more and more nervous. And this, for me, his speech indicates nervousness and trying to crack down. But on the other hand, cracking down would be undermine his legitimacy as the supreme
leader.
Where's
the military? Nari, where's the heart and soul of the military?
Well, there is the military is two different divisions. One is the regular army, and then there is the Revolutionary Guard, which was created as a parallel institution because the revolutionary leaders did not trust the army itself. Okay. So the Revolutionary Guard is loyal to the system, but we are hearing rumors that the rank and file of the Revolutionary Guard are not so loyal because they believe their bosses in Revolutionary Guard are really gangster capitalists who are trying to protect their own system, and they're trying to get rid of the republic within the Islamic Republic so they cannot be accountable to anyone. So we do not know if a war and a civil war breaks out how the loyalty of the Revolutionary Guard is going to be. Are they going to follow the orders of their commanders? We don't know.
You said the magic words. How realistic is a civil war?
I think that civil war is a realistic possibility, although not likely, I would say. I still believe that there might be a negotiated settlement to this. I hear proposals for a possible national unity government being floated around within the behind-the-scenes negotiations going on. God knows where we will be, but as we say, inshallah, this will all end well without violence.
Edie?
Absolutely. I think I agree with what Nariman said, and I don't think a civil war break out in the near future, and I agree that they are trying to resolve this more peacefully. But one thing that's certain is that the legitimacy of Khamenei as a supreme leader has been weakened enormously. And I think this is an important fact that's going to make it harder for the regime to try to ignore what's been going on within the opposition.
Back to my question about Rafsanjani. If he's the president of the Assembly of Experts who appoint the supreme commander, can there be a meeting of that group and the supreme commander is changed?
Unfortunately, not.
Okay.
Because many of the members of the assembly are people who are much closer to Khamenei. They've benefited from his supreme leadership. They've benefited economically and politically. And therefore, it's very unlikely that they would side with Rafsanjani. One of the interesting things...
30 seconds left.
Well, some of the major ayatollahs are beginning to come and side with Mousavi because they know that Mousavi doesn't want to undermine the regime but make it more acceptable to the electorate.
Gidi Nashat, thank you very much for joining us from the Hoover Institution. Mark Zevin, thank you very much for joining us as well with the Jewish Reconstructionist Movement. And also Nariman Savari, thank you very much for joining us, a native of Tehran, Iran, also a United States citizen, as well as all of our guests are. We thank you very much for joining us. Obviously, this is not going to be resolved by next Sunday night. We'll continue to talk about it. It is a key challenge to the future of the Obama administration, to see how he plays it. And also, by the way, a couple of weeks ago, Gidi was a guest on this program. If you're watching or you're listening to this program in Chicago, tonight on the television version, Gidi Nashat will be on that broadcast, and it was quite a lively discussion. You'll see it tonight on television. Channel 20 at 10:30. I'm Bruce Dumont, back shortly from Chicago Live.
My name's Jason Bradshaw. I used to drive a Jaguar XJ8L before the Cadillac. When the lease came up, I ended up looking into the CTS and had never even seen the car. Had only seen pictures on the internet, had only read reviews in the magazines. Immediately it struck me. I ended up going to the dealership that day, took one look at this thing. It was a fully loaded Cadillac CTS. Right there I had to order one. The interior appointments, to me, blows doors off of any of the other imports. My fiance has a Lexus. To me now, they look cheap. I don't think I'd be able to go back to Jaguar or Mercedes or BMW. Having the Cadillac CTS shifted my outlook on what GM can do altogether.
To hear more of Jason's story and to listen to other real stories from GM owners, go to GMReinvention.com.
now, another reason to switch to GEICO.
Every month, we get lots of letters telling us how much folks like GEICO's claim service. And I quote, "The adjuster assigned to my claim was incredible. He walked me through everything." Then there's this one. GEICO.com is very useful and lets you track your claims. And this. "I filed a claim at 4:15 on Thursday afternoon, and my car was in the shop at 10 a.m. on Friday." And my personal favorite, "Easy squeezy lemon peasy."
For a free rate quote, visit GEICO.com or call 1-800-947-AUTO.
I'm Mark Galbarian, president of Goldline. Call Goldline today at 877-361-COIN and let us show you how you can acquire gold that's shipped directly to you. That's gold you can hold in your hand, not some paper promise. Receive free shipping on your first order and there's no sales tax. The number to call is 877-361-COIN. We'll send you a free brochure, newsletter, and DVD. Don't wait to get this valuable information. Call 877-361-COIN, 877-361-COIN.
I'm Felix. I've been doing tattoos for over 15 years. I get people in here who ask me about removing a tattoo they don't want anymore. I've really had nothing to help. And then I discovered Wrecking Balm. It's an easy daily fading system. The darkest, deepest pigments, they easily fade without any discoloring, blemishing, or scarring the skin. Wrecking Balm is really the best thing for tattoo regret.
Call right now, 1-800-507-4221 for your in-home 60-day risk-free trial. That's 1-800-507-4221. That's 1-800-507-4221.
With Welcome Rewards from Hotels.com, you get a free night after accumulating 10 nights with any of their partner hotels.
Surely my boutique hotel is not included in that.
Yes, it is, lady.
My band, Sned Leplin, stays in chain hotels just off the freeway. Those included?
With Hotels.com, you bet, Mr. Brojangles.
What about a bed and breakfast?
Faux shizzle.
Hotels on the moon?
No.
Accumulate 10 nights, even at different hotels, and earn a free night. Welcome rewards from Hotels.com. Smart. So smart. Some restrictions apply. See site for details.
Live from Chicago, this is Bruce Dumont. We continue with hour number two of Beyond the Beltway. In this hour, featuring commentary by Bruno Behrend and Ralph Martiri. And a little bit later on in the broadcast, we'll hear a report from California and talk show host Mark Carbonaro. Our program tonight coming to you from our home base at the SiriusXM studios on Chicago's West Side. Phone lines open at 1-800-723-8289. We are going to shift gears now, and we're going to be talking about taxes and fiscal matters, both at the national level and the state level. Obviously, everybody knows that there have been serious fiscal problems in the country, and that has rippled down to virtually all 50 states. They have serious fiscal problems as well. We're going to be talking about that. And also the frustration that voters have. Is there a real – is there a tax revolt that is out there? Because there are many governors around the United States who believe that raising taxes is the answer. We want to get your reaction to that. And obviously, as governors look for ways to cut the budget and to reduce their deficits, they are talking about serious cuts in state programs, serious cuts in social services that are delivered to the poor and those that need help. And again, many feel that we are well beyond the bone when it gets to some of these cuts. And there have been draconian suggestions, not only in the state of Illinois, where this broadcast comes from, but also in California, where they have a $24 billion deficit. We'll talk about that in about a half an hour. But I want to get my guests because I think they have sort of a differing opinion on taxes and taxation and government services. Ralph Martiri, thank you very much for joining us. Bruno, thank you as well.
Thank you.
I would like to begin, first of all, with you, Bruno. Your general assessment of the way in which the Obama administration is addressing the fiscal crisis that they found on day one.
I think they're spending too much money. Clearly, there's a dropout in the amount of money coming into the federal government, so that's a huge problem. There's a slowdown in the economy, and these are all things that it's fair to say, even as a conservative, that Obama inherited this from the previous administration and all the different things that were happening with the financial meltdown. So I don't think anybody really complains about the proper allocation of deficit spending to keep the economy afloat, to keep, you know, the financial system functioning.
But the question is, where is that money going? Is it being wisely spent? And then the other thing, and I think some governors have been worried about this on the state level, is some of the stimulus money doing nothing more than to lock in a permanent, you know, what I would call a patronage army of employees that are, you know, public employees that are coming in.
Ralph, your assessment of the Obama administration policies thus far?
Well, I think some of this stuff has to come out in the open. I mean, what we do know is that we've gone from in year 2001 a projection of annual surpluses of over $800 billion a year to $1.2 trillion annual deficits a year at the federal level. That much we know. And there's been a big analysis done of CBO projections and what's contributed to this. And interestingly enough, 37% of its economic downturns, right, the financial market collapse, all that other stuff, 33% of it is Bush administration policies on primarily tax cuts, the Iraq war, and Medicare. Then 20% of it is Obama continuing Bush's tax cuts in the Iraq war and the stimulus program passed by President Bush, the TARP program, which really was, talk about something that wasn't very accountable to taxpayers and voters. We really didn't have any strings attached to that, mm-hmm. that money going out to the private sector. And then only 7% of it is Obama's stimulus plan and 3% of it is Obama's spending plans on things like health care and education, et cetera. So I think we're focusing as a nation way too much on the newest proposals on the table that Obama has put out, like on health care and education, and not on the really big problems that have contributed to deficit, the poor tax policy and Medicare problems in the Iraq war.
You alluded to the first wave of government money that went out to bail out the banks on George Bush's watch. And the fact that there were very few checks and balances on that money. There have been recent reports, however, that many of the banks have already paid their loans back. So can we say right now that at least the first wave, again, the Bush wave of government support of failing industries, is it safe to say that that was a bad mistake, that they made a mistake?
Well, they made a mistake not in trying to get involved and help out the industries, but they made a mistake in not putting any requirements on how the money would be utilized once they got it. I mean, if I was a venture capitalist coming in as the government to write a $300 billion check to 9 banks,
right,
I'd have some requisites on how they were going to use the money once I wrote the check, right? I mean, any venture capitalist would do that. We didn't, and that really created a problem. So the banks used it for a lot of things banks would traditionally do, like acquiring profitable banks rather than non-profitable banks.
Compensation packages,
but not for what we wanted them to do, and that's stimulate the economy and start lending at least to credit-worthy borrowers. And I think that's what we really wanted to accomplish.
Is there your reaction to the same question, Bruno?
Well, I don't really know if separating the Obama bailout and the Bush bailout, I would consider anything that was a bailout to be a bad idea. There is a qualitative difference between what they did in the early 90s with the Resolution Trust problem with this SNL crisis, where they basically mothballed failed institutions and they had other banks, solvent banks and other people who wanted to buy the assets to go out and buy the performing assets, which is what we should have done here. Goldman Sachs is not the economy. If Goldman Sachs and they seem to be the one of the few that were nearly solvent, but I think that the people out there, and this is what's making – this goes back to your what makes people angry out there. Number one, there was opacity, complete lack of transparency on what the TARP money was actually doing. And then you start hearing about compensation packages. You start hearing about how they're not really using the money to lend, which is what they supposedly wanted. And then you're basically looking at them doing what I think is the biggest mistake is they're actually trying to recreate what Japan did for 10 years, which was a failure, which is to prop up failed institutions somehow and keep on having them stuck to the federal dollar. And not every bank is doing that. Some are giving it back. But you're actually propping up failed institutions as opposed to letting the institutions go under and parceling out the assets that and depositors in those institutions.
In the broader stimulus package, the $787 billion package, which is being sprinkled through states in addition to some dollars staying in Washington, how will we know and when will we see the first indication as to whether those funds are being wisely used?
Well, fortunately, at least the Obama administration did something very different than the Bush administration on that. They required some transparency and accountability in the utilization of those funds. So state governments, Illinois, for instance, has to set up a website. They have to show how the money's being spent. And there's a lot of real tight restraints on how the money can be spent. So, for instance, in Illinois, the money we're getting, $7.2 billion, the vast majority of it has to go to three things. Has to go to K through 12 education, capital projects, or health care, period. There's not a lot of wiggle room, and the state government has to report back exactly how they're using that money in the first tranche that they get, or they don't get the second tranche. So at least we know with a lot more detail how the money is going to be used, and it's going to be used for the things we wanted.
I want to come back and talk about those areas.
So do
and Bruno, I.
I
know you've got some comments as well. 1-800-723-8029. We're talking about your money, your tax dollars. When you send them to Washington or your state capital, are they coming back? And how you want them used? And are you willing to pay more for the services you get? And do you care about the poor person down the street? 1-800-723-8289.
Hey, over here.
Who said that?
It's me, hon. Last year's Father's Day gift. You know, the nose hair trimmer.
Oh.
So what's this I hear about you getting him a TomTom GPS this year?
Well, Dad's kind of obsessed with shortcuts. So with TomTom's IQ routes, he'll always know the fastest way to get anywhere.
What, are you trying to make me look bad or something?
No, I
just... Gee, I wonder what Dad'll like more. Brilliant all-knowing TomTom or a nose hair trimmer? It is so over for me.
Say goodbye to lame Father's Day gifts. Say hello to TomTom.
Reason number 48 to switch to Geico.
As much as you enjoy the experience, you won't have to go to the post office. We can automatically debit your checking account or even charge your premium to your credit card. It's easy and you never have to worry about mailing your car insurance premium again. But we must warn you, you won't get to use any postage stamps. I hear they're coming out with some pretty cool designs.
For a free rate quote, visit geico.com or call 1-800-947-AUTO. 15 minutes could save you 15% or more on car insurance.
Bruce Dumont back in Chicago. Thanks very much for joining us tonight. 1-800-723-8289. Two calls in just a few moments. But Bruno Barron, you wanted to follow up on some of the oversight that
right.
The Obama administration has put in place for some of their dollars that are sending their tax dollars.
Well, a couple
that
of
are sending back to us.
Right. A couple of things. Number one, Obama is of two minds on transparency. I mean, when he was a senator, he did co-author a transparency bill for the federal government, which is a positive. He's also been he said that we're not going to have any lobbyists become part of the administration. And then he just this last week, I think he refused to disclose the number of times he's actually had exceptions to that policy, because some of the people in the Senate were asking, wait a minute, how many exceptions have you made to this already? And after five or six exceptions, they just stopped telling us. So there's a couple of things about transparency. On the three things that Ralph mentioned, K through 12, capital projects, and health care, K through 12 is one of the reasons all of the states are experiencing massive budget problems. And that is because we have turned our education system in Illinois and in pretty much across America into a patronage farm. So loading up more K through 12 spending when we really aren't getting our bang for our buck in public education is one problem. The capital projects, there's good capital projects and there's bad capital projects. The gentleman I'm working for right now who's running for governor points out that when you have a capital project to build a river walk in a town that doesn't have a river, which is one of the capital projects they're lobbying for, or right where Ralph and I live in River Forest, they're spending, I think, 90 or 100 or so, maybe even multiple hundreds of thousands of dollars on a exploratory committee to put a cap over the Eisenhower, a ludicrous proposition in anybody's book. You're looking at an unbelievable amount of waste in this so-called stimulus package, and when why don't we just bail out everybody's mortgage who can't pay it, and we'll end up with much better financial shape.
We've got a caller on the line. Let's go to Carl, listening to us on our flagship station, WLS Radio in Chicago. Go ahead, Carl.
Hi, guys. I'm really fuming mad nowadays that about education and so forth on every sector, college, K to 12, like you guys mentioned, and so forth. It's like we're isn't doing a hill of beans, you know, and for decades and decades, you know, they keep asking and asking for more, and the kids are getting dumber and dumber. And also, what the bad part of it the next bad part of it is we're spending more on the penal system, that we're incarcerating a lot of people, you know, ready to rot all the time, you know, for decades to rot at our expense. Why can't we execute some of these people so it will save a lot of taxpaying dollars?
Well, you know? I don't think you're gonna get much political support on either party about executing people just to save a little money. But let's speak to your initial point, unless you want to defend that policy, Ralph, which I don't think you do. Let's get to the slice of this that's going through K through 12. Where is it going to be used, and is it basically propping up the education system, where in some municipalities and some sectors of the country, it really is an extension of almost a patronage army?
Well, I'd like to go to the area where it's an extension of a patronage army, because when I go through, and my organization's bipartisan, we've analyzed K through 12 education in a number of states, not just Illinois. We've looked at Ohio, and we've looked at Kansas, we've looked at Michigan, we've looked at Indiana. It doesn't appear to be that there's this patronage army. These are, for the most part, your standard quality teachers that go through college. The problem with the K through 12 system has been, for decades, we've never tied the funding levels, Bruce, to any sort of sense of the actual cost of delivering a quality education that's outcome-based. If you don't know what it costs to generate your outcome, your input is going to be messed up one way or another. If you're going to build a car, you would certainly know what it would cost to build that car. Now, a few years ago, at least in Illinois, we retained outside consultants that have established education funding for 35 states. They are nonpartisan. They are experts. And what they looked at was the educational cost per kid in Illinois ought to be about $2,000 per child higher than what it is if you wanted to get two-thirds of our non-at-risk kids actually passing the state standardized tests. Now, we've never gotten up to that standard. We throw a few more dollars in every year, but we never get out to the standard. So if you don't get to the standard where you could generate results, you're not going to generate results, and you really are wasting money. And in Illinois, the actual cost of education funding reform would be about $3.1 billion in total, which sounds like a big number. We have a $633 billion economy. It's less than one-half of 1% of our state's economy. We are one of the lowest spending states in the nation overall. Our state government spending, we only spend, as a total percentage of our state economy, 3%. That ranks 45th in the nation. We have the fifth largest population. We're not meeting need. We absolutely should raise the revenue to fund education in an appropriate way that's tied to objective criteria, measurable criteria, so that we could expect a certain outcome. Now, the cost of implementing reforms, and one thing Arnie Duncan has done in D.C. is talk about reforming things. The cost of implementing reforms like higher quality teachers, smaller class sizes, extended days, extended school years, all cost more than what we're doing today.
Let's go to Boise, Idaho, where Paul is listening to us on KBOI. Go ahead.
How you doing?
Fine. How are you?
Pretty good. I wanted to talk about the way the stimulus package is being handed out. Why didn't they take the sum of money that they had, which is close to $1 trillion, divide it by amount of households in the country and passed out enough money so people could have taken that money, paid off bills, or after paying off bills, bought other things to keep the economy going all the way around instead of putting into areas like the banks which hoarded the money or bought other banks and didn't loan the money out, but didn't just give it directly back to us since it is our money. And
yeah, that's what I think Bruno was suggesting earlier in the broadcast.
That's pretty much been my point. If they just wrote, if every, and I'm not saying that every single person who took advantage of liar loans and all the different things on the financial bailout and all the different problems with the real estate industry, I'm not saying they deserved a bailout, but I don't think the banks deserved a bailout either. If you're going to bail somebody out, everybody who's has trouble with their non-performing mortgages, you know, give them the money to bring their mortgage back up to even. And the next thing you know, you've got all this consumer spending and all the different things that they say is 62% of the economy. I'm just chomping at the bit to respond to some of the thing Ralph said about K through 12 going back to the state budget situation, because it's so interesting to have two people from looking at the same problem from two opposite perspectives. I mean, what is interesting is, just out of luck, we both live in the same community. And I think there was a real simple statistic. There's a, and this is a real number. Recent superintendent retired a few years ago, went from 146 1 year, 1,000, up to about 168, then up to 192, ended up over a five-year period going from $146,000 to $226,000, all to artificially increase a pension level, turns around and retires at 55 on 75% of her salary. The amount of education spending just to ramp that number up is obscene, and this is and it's not a single instance. This has happened everywhere in the property tax rich district. So you're spending money on pension and perk and payroll expansion. Is every single person, like, class size is another perfect example. They take a study out of Tennessee where they reduce class size, and it looks like it actually worked. And in fact, a teacher teaching 30 kids using a good curriculum can outperform two teachers teaching 15 kids how to read using a bad curriculum. So I think you're talking about EFAB, Ralph, for the people, Education Funding Board. They look at one thing and one thing only, the top-down, unionized, administrative-heavy model, and then they sit there and say, well, we need to spend this much more money to educate the children, when in fact, if you just had the money follow the children, we'd figure out lots of different ways to save.
Ralph.
All right, well, there's a bunch of malarkey in what he just said, and not bad malarkey, but good. But one point Bruno just made that's exactly right is the abuses of the pension system that do take place in affluent communities. Those property tax-rich areas that could really inflate salaries do it, and they do it to attract top talent. It's a problem. It's an abuse. It should be stopped. No one should accept it. That said, statewide, our pension system provides a pretty moderate retirement benefit. Teachers, in fact, on average retire with a benefit of about $38,000 a year for a family of two. And remember, they don't get Social Security. So that would be their retirement benefit overall. State workers are much less. They average anywhere between $18,000 and $22,000. So from a materiality standpoint, it's small. And as for bloated administration, administrative costs statewide in Illinois for K-12 education are only 3.6%. Show me a business with a 3.6%.
It's a much higher number. It's really a much higher number.
Brian and Schomburg, you're on the air coast to coast. Go ahead.
Hi, good evening, gentlemen. I know we could do a two-hour show on it, but nobody wants to talk about illegal immigration and the funding that that requires to subsidize these impoverished people that are sneaking into our country, and neither party wants to do anything about it. And
Bruno, how big a problem is it?
It is not a small.
I agree with Brian. Nobody wants to touch it, but
well, and somebody should.
Everybody's afraid of it.
Brian is right on one issue, and somebody should touch it. And quite frankly, what no one has done anywhere no one has taken an actual accounting of whatever benefits we get from the influx of labor when we had a growing economy and we needed a lot of labor, and what the benefits of that labor was. Everybody wants to be politically correct, and it's like the business community, along with the very many Democratic constituencies as well, like the idea of having a whole bunch of people come in here and you know, because they create a constituency that each one likes. One is cheap labor, and the other one is a group of people they can give welfare benefits to. But if we actually did an accounting on this, I think we'd find that the problem with public employee pensions and public unionization is much bigger than the illegal immigration problem.
1-800-723-8029. When we come back, we're going to be joined by a guest from California. They are $24 billion in the red. The new fiscal year is coming up in a couple of weeks, less than a couple of weeks. I'm Bruce Dumont, back shortly from Chicago.
With Welcome Rewards from Hotels.com, you get a free night after accumulating 10 nights with any of their partner hotels.
Surely my boutique hotel is not included in that.
Yes, it is, lady.
My band, Sned Leplin, stays in chain hotels just off the freeway. Those included.
With Hotels.com, you bet, Mr. Brojangles.
What about a bed and breakfast?
Faux shizzle.
Hotels on the moon?
No.
Accumulate 10 nights, even at different hotels, and earn a free night. Welcome rewards from Hotels.com. Smart. So smart. Some restrictions apply. See site for details.
Shaquille O'Neal for Icy Hot.
I need pain relief that won't mess with my grip.
The new Icy Hot No Mess Applicator. Powerful, targeted, long-lasting pain relief now in a roll-on applicator. No mess. Just maximum strength medicine for back, shoulders, knees, even arthritis. Massages in icy to dull the pain, hot to relax it away.
Wherever I hurt, wherever I go.
Stop pain right at the source with the new Icy Hot No Mess Applicator.
No pain, no mess.
For temporary topical pain relief, use only as directed.
Bruce Dumont back in Chicago. Thank you very much for joining us. Around the table in Chicago, we have Ralph Martiri. He is the Executive Director of the Center for Tax and Budget Accountability. And Bruno Berend is here. He is with ExtremeWisdom.com. He's also a talk show host. In fact, tomorrow morning, he's going to be on WKRS radio for much of this week. And again, they are debating their differing opinions on taxes and fiscal matters relating to state government and federal government as well. And joining us right now is Mark Carbonaro. Mark, good afternoon. Nice to have you with us.
Hey, thank you very much, Bruce.
I almost said good morning because you're the morning guy on KION Radio, our affiliate out there in California. And it's nice to have you back because I know that you have your hand on the pulse of California voters. And I mentioned before the break that there's been a lot of publicity about the $24 billion deficit in the state of California. We have read stories about increased in taxes and massive cuts that are on their way to the state of California. And I want to get a sense from you, the outrage, the frustration of the people who call your show. Is it about keeping the taxes down? Or are they complaining because services that they need are about to be cut?
Well, I'd say it's actually the former and not the latter. What we're and a little bit of some of it. Here's what we get from our listeners, and you have to bear in mind that you're dealing with conservative talk radio, so they're coming at it from their own particular prejudice. But it's that we don't want any more tax increases, and then number two, if you are going to cut spending. How dare you cut public safety? We want you to be making cuts in other areas. We don't want the old, what they call the Washington Monument Syndrome, and I don't know if you've ever heard about this, but economists talk about this. It's, government gets into a fix, and this is based on something, the National Park Service did years ago, and they've got to cut their budget. And so the first thing they say is, well, if we cut our budget, we're going to have to close the Washington Monument. And, of course, nobody wants the Washington Monument or Yellowstone National Park to be closed, so that's kind of the end of the conversation right there. So what you're seeing here in California is always the first thing the politicians come out with is, well, we're going to have to cut public safety, police and firefighters. And it's, and but people have gotten wise to that, Bruce. People are kind of, they're hip to that. We've been there and we've done that, and that isn't acceptable. And I'll give you an example where there's one area that the governor hasn't talked about cutting, and none of the Democrats or Republicans in the legislature have talked about cutting, and that is the number of state commissions and boards that we have. We have over 500 state commissions and boards in California. We have a waste management board that is nothing more than a landing zone for termed out state legislators, because we have term limits in California for members of our state assembly and state senate. And these are jobs that pay in excess of $100,000 a year. They have staffs that spend money, and some of these boards and commissions are in charge of budgets, or they have advisory roles in how dollars are spent. And yet there's no talk at all about cutting out these boards and commissions. Go ahead.
What they have talked about, again, the $24 billion budget, you're going to run out of cash by late July, according to the published reports.
That's correct.
And what the governor has done in concert with the legislature, proposed closing 200 state parks, there are those parks, releasing prisoners early, selling state property, laying off state workers, and cutting health benefits. Under the plan, K-12 schools and community colleges would lose $5.3 billion over the coming year, on top of billions of dollars in recent reductions, and the state would spend $7,806 per student in 2009 and 2010. That's a 10% reduction in what they spent 2 years ago, and also the federal stimulus funds have prevented deeper cuts to a public school system that educates 6.3 million students, 25% of which do not speak English.
Right.
So can you speak to the last call we had in the last segment, and that is, what is the true impact of illegal immigration on all aspects of state-related funding programs?
It's hard to know because the numbers that we get vary widely. And one of the reasons why it's so difficult to know is that because it's throughout California, cities and special districts and school districts all have either policies or laws that prevent them from collecting data as to the national origin of people and their status, you know, their immigration status in this country. So you just can basically work on estimates, and you've got some lowball numbers and some high numbers. So I couldn't tell you honestly what the exact impact fiscally in California is, because nobody knows. Look, we don't even know how many cars the state of California owns. I had State Senator Jeff Denham on my program recently, and Senator Denham is the Republican state senator who's pushing to sell the L.A. Coliseum and the Cow Palace in San Francisco and San Quentin, a number of outdated state facilities. And Senator Denham made the point that when they tried to get an audit of how many vehicles the state of California owned, there was not one place where you could go and find out what the taxpayers are committed
well,
to.
Well, that frustration, Mark, I think is going to be shared by our caller from Joliet, Illinois, who joins our conversation. Dave is listening to us on WLS, but you're on with Mark Carbonaro of KION Radio in California, and you're talking to a national audience. Go ahead, Dave.
Yes, I like your show so much. I got your name in my cell phone, and I try to get in there.
Thank you.
Something just in my mind. You know, any state and federal government that worries about a fish and puts 80,000 farmers out of business in a state that's hurting and in financial straits, I mean, you got to start looking at what are we doing. I'm from Chicago area. I was born and raised in Chicago. My motto, Chicago's broke, Cook County's broke, Illinois's broke, California's broke, and the Chicago Fed politicians running this country are going to break this country. They're printing money like Monopoly. There's no rationale sense. And my thing is, and like I told your screener, I think we got to have California go bankrupt and a lot of these other states that have crazy politicians spending money like going out of style and learn how to say the answer is no. No. What don't you understand about it? No. This program isn't going to exist. That program isn't going to exist. We're going to concentrate on what's economically reasonable to bring the state, to bring the localities, and to bring this country back on track.
All right, stay on the line. Mark, to you, what would happen if the state of California went bankrupt? Tell us what life in California would be like, and what would happen?
You know, there's been some conjecture about that. And of course, if the state did go bankrupt, what will we end up, you know, having? And what I've heard is that essentially, you know, we'd be dealing with the shutdown of our state university system, both the UC and the Cal State universities, along with community colleges. There would still be public safety, but for the most part, it would be taken care of by your county sheriffs and your police departments, and so law enforcement would be spread very thin. But they haven't really gotten into, you know, into the weeds as to this is what California state government will look like at the end of July if we run out of money in the state.
Well, isn't the reality here is we've got a federal government that bails out the automobile companies, and they bail out the banks. Is the federal government going to bail out the states, Bruno? Let's get Bruno's reaction to that.
I don't know what the federal government can do to bail out the states. Now, obviously, they can just print more money. But the thing is that if you look at what's going on in Illinois and California, those are what Ralph euphemistically calls structural deficits. And there just isn't enough tax dollars in California or Illinois and many of the other states that are experiencing problems to pay for the so-called structural deficits that are expanded out in the future. So if the bankruptcies succeed in workouts that include dramatic reductions in health care costs and unionization costs in terms of pensions and public dollars, that might work. But if it just means that we're going to keep on printing money to bail out Illinois and California, that's not going
to
work.
Ralph, response to you.
Yeah, well, there's a lot to say there. And number one is we really in Illinois have a revenue problem, not a spending problem.
What
and
about
I haven't,
in California?
I haven't analyzed California as closely, so I don't know where their balance is.
But what
and
about the concept of a bailout?
But
is the federal can the federal government bail out?
It could.
Because
but you
if
know
you
what?
Can't let General Motors fail, why should you be able to let California
but Bruce,
fail?
Bruce, here's the problem with the federal bailout in my mind. It's temporary money. It's good for a year or two or three. At some point, states have got to either be able to support their operating spending or not do it. I mean, we could probably all agree on that.
Ralph and I agree on that, yeah.
So the next question is your operational spending out of control, and do you have the state revenue to support it? In Illinois, at least, and I don't know the California situation as well, but in Illinois, at least, our spending is not out of control. We're a very low-spending state. And what we call a structural deficit is just that every year, if you just wanted to maintain your services from year one to year two, you couldn't if you just kept up with inflation. That's not expanding a service or whatever. It means your revenues don't grow with the economy, but your costs do. So this isn't my theory. This is the theory of Nobel Prize-winning economist Stiglitz. It's the theory of Mark Zandi, the chief economist at Moody's.com, who's no liberal. He was the economic advisor to McCain in his presidential run. They say for state governments during a recession ought to raise tax revenue progressively. That means focusing on more affluent people and invest that money in public expenditures to save and create jobs and shorten the recessionary cycle. That's the sound capitalist economic thing to do, and especially when you're a low tax, low spending state like Illinois and you've already eviscerated at least human services over the last decade.
Taxes are already going up in California. Mark, I know you've got to run because it's Father's Day. We thank you very much. If your listeners to the broadcast are tuned into our program this evening, let's get more reaction from the Golden State at 1-800-723-8289. Tonight, taking America's political pulse from coast to coast and border to border and from San Francisco to San Diego.
For most of my life, I've been a lot more concerned with my pitching arm than my prostate health. But then I learned that 1 in 3 men will develop prostate issues. I don't like that stat one bit. Now, I take a complete multivitamin with more. One a day men's. It's got more selenium than Centrum to support prostate health, and it supports heart health too, which for me is a winning combination. Strike!
One a day men's, the official multivitamin of Major League Baseball.
And now, another reason to switch to Geico.
Every month, we get lots of letters telling us how much folks like Geico's claim service. And I quote, "The adjuster assigned to my claim was incredible. He walked me through everything." Then there's this one. Geico.com is very useful and lets you track your claims. And this. "I filed a claim at 4:15 on Thursday afternoon, and my car was in the shop at 10 a.m. on Friday." And my personal favorite, "Easy Squeezy Lemon Peasy."
For a free rate quote, visit Geico.com or call 1-800-947-AUTO.
Bruce Dumont back in Chicago, 1-800-723-8289. I want to, and this is a general question, not specific to any particular state, but one of the things that a lot of governors are having to deal with is what about those on the lower rung of the social structure? And the ones that may need it the most. In your view, how badly are they going to be hurt under the general climate that we are in? And most importantly, is there any other nonprofit, church-related social service, a safety net that is out there that can assist these people
who cannot assist themselves? Here's the biggest misconception about that. Illinois is not an employment state. I'm going to use Illinois as an example. Most states aren't. Most states outsource human services, the vast majority of them. So this safety net you're talking about, Catholic Charities, Lutheran Social Services, JU, all those people, the Jewish Federation, they get most of their funding from state government. And state government doesn't pay them a dollar for a dollar of service. And in Illinois, we pay about 67 cents to every one of these provider agencies for a dollar worth of services back. So the bottom line is, when state government cuts spending on human services, what they are doing is cutting spending on jobs in the private sector that help the most vulnerable populations in the state and that are subsidized
and
by private contributions.
And a question that someone might have is that if a church is engaged in social services, which certainly is a good thing for a church to be engaged in, what contribution is the church making to that service? In other words, it's nice to know that taxpayers are helping those in trouble. But again, where
about one-third of the revenue comes from private contributions, whether it's a specific church or not. About one-third of the revenue to these agencies comes from private contributions, and about two-thirds comes from state government.
Let's just stay on this. Is that a fair division of where revenue should come from? Because you have churches that are on tax-exempt property.
Mm-hmm. Well,
many of them are immensely wealthy, right?
Well,
and they have no obligation to provide one service.
Well, first of all,
it's not their responsibility. It's state government.
Now we
got to
be comparing apples to apples here.
Wait! I want to hear.
Where is it in the charter of any church that their responsibility is something other than the spiritual life of their congregation? It doesn't exist.
Let's not mix things here.
Well, when they decide to do charitable acts, they decide to do that. But it is not the responsibility of the churches to take care of our infirm, of our elderly, of our people with disabilities, of our abused and neglected children. It is great that they step in and help.
Religion can't do that. Religious entities shouldn't be doing that?
Let's separate out a few things here. First of all, what Ralph mentioned something very important about how our budget, particularly here in Illinois, is a grant-making budget. It pushes grants out the door to various social service agencies and other agencies. Now, the interesting thing about that is that we need to look at every single grant going out the door because we know, we've done the research working on this campaign, that there are numerous places to cut really stupid and ugly spending where we can actually be doing more for social services. And this goes right back to the Washington Monument thing. I think what you're doing, Bruce, is I think you're trying to ask a question of whether a specific church or churches in general should be tax exempt in terms of property taxes.
No. I'm saying should they contribute more? I mean, Ralph and I have a serious disagreement here.
Mm-hmm.
It seems to me that one of the things that a church should do if they have the mechanism,
mm-hmm.
if they're on tax-exempt property and the church is well-heeled, and most churches are very well-heeled, if you have people who are down on their luck, who need basic services to survive, regardless of what the religion is,
mm-hmm.
why are you not helping those people? Why is it the responsibility or two-thirds of the responsibility of state government and taxpayers to help people? If there are people in need, isn't that one of the things that religion should do, is to help people in need?
Certainly, and I think there's many, many religious organizations, NGOs, nonprofits that are religiously affiliated that are doing just that, and I think that that's one of the reasons why I think
is two-third, one-third? Do you think that's a good mix?
I don't know that it is. Again, to answer your question specifically, and this is where I think every single one of these problems, I mean, if we're in the last few minutes here and people want to know how to solve this problem, whether it's the church question you asked, whether it's the education question, whether it's how this stuff is funded, one of the things that we're working on here is with today's technology, every single dime of government money should be able to be put online in real time so that every single person who wants to see what the government is doing can look at it in real time. And you know what? The people of Illinois and the people of California and the people of America are smart enough to sit there and say, that's wasteful. That doesn't need spending, but this is good spending. And I think that that's where 100% financial transparency is doable.
I'm not so sure I agree with that. I mean, conceptually, I think it's good to know where the money is spent. You know, whether any individual, and I mean any individual, can make an absolute, wiser judgment if they don't know all the reasons why certain things are funded, I'm not so sure that any one person can
make. And Bruce, you know, just to get back to the delivery of social services, I mean, if you look at the most impoverished communities across the state, not just in the Chicago region, Bruce, but throughout the state of Illinois, you dare you to find a wealthy church in that community. There are wealthy churches in wealthy areas, and they simply don't have the money within their individual congregation, and frankly, it'd be too high of a burden to put voluntarily on people within one community to just go out and support everybody else across the state. That's what tax revenue is for, is to cover these big social issues. And then the positive thing you get from
but
that...
But they shouldn't necessarily have to be expanded, Ralph.
But
I think
Bruce,
that,
when,
I
when,
think
state
when
government,
you have a program...
When state government provides it, you get it provided systematically. You get credentials brought into the system. You get professionalization.
And that's worked out very well.
And frankly... The human service providers are doing us a great service by subsidizing the cost of what should be a public service and covering a third.
I understand that, and when they provide services, they should be paid. But again, regardless of the state, when politicians expand programs without the mechanism for paying for those programs, that is systemic irresponsibility.
Absolutely.
And that's how you get
Bruce,
$24 billion in deficit.
But
in California.
I agree, we're
out of time. Ralph Bartieri, Bruno Barron, thank you very much for joining this program.
It's
a Genevieve production produced by WLS Radio and Genevieve Productions. Ben Stewart and Patrick Johnson helped make this program possible. Until next week, this is Bruce Dumont. Good night from Chicago.